KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
I'm running for port commissioner to help lead the port in building our regional economy while minimizing our ecological footprint. We can do both. And in fact, we can't do one without the other. They go hand in hand.
Putting more money into the current system and expecting different results is, you know, the definition of, I think, insanity.
Whenever I am troubled, said the librarian, I think about the Dewey Decimal System.
Nancy Pearl's going to be here this hour on weekday. She's going to talk about some self-help books and also get some of your suggestions. Steve Litzo talking about the definition of insanity, which is putting money into a broken system. He'll tell us how he's going to fix that system, not all by himself, but he has some ideas. And Tom Albro, port commissioner, why he ran for the port commission position, joins us to talk about some other port issues this hour on the program, the Port of Seattle. Thank you for being here.
Glad to be here, Steve.
Tom Albro is the port commission president, ending his first full elected term as the as a representative of the port. So, port commission, this is actually, before we get to the business of you being here, I just would like to ask you, and then I'm going to circle back around to the issue. King 5 is reporting a tweet from last night. So it's a rumor on top of a rumor on top of a tweet that the Sacramento Kings were purchased by Chris Hansen. Have you heard anything?
Is that right? Oh, I guess I'm not on their followers list.
You didn't get that?
I didn't get that one. Well, you know, that's good for Chris Hansen if that's the case.
So nobody called you up to say, here's what we think is happening.
Oh, that's right.
All right. All right, I'm going to come back to the questions of the
okay.
of the stadium. But so Port Commissioner Gail Carlton is she's resigning January 31st. She takes her seat in the Washington State House January 31st.
Her last day as a Port Commissioner is January 31st. She'll be sworn in as a legislator earlier than that. Next week, I think.
Yeah, in the Washington State House of Representatives. So you have to appoint her successor within 90 days. How does that appointment process work?
So the Port Commission's obligated to make an appointment. We have 90 days to do it by state law. So the remaining four commissioners will be going through a process, which I'll describe, and hopefully making an appointment on March 5th.
March 5th?
March 5th.
So you'll get there by then. Who's being considered?
Well, right now, I don't think the list is narrow enough to start rattling off names. So we are formally announcing and publicizing the position tomorrow and giving any interested person 15 business days to reply and apply online.
So anybody can do it?
Anybody can do it. And matter of fact, I really want to encourage your listeners to consider doing it. I mean, public service through elected office is something that too few people actually are willing to take on.
Are you enjoying the effort
yourself? You know, it's like every job, right? There's some things that you like and there's things that you don't. And unfortunately, you have to do both. But all in all, I'd say it's very worthwhile.
All right. All right. So anybody can apply. What do they have to tell you? Anything in particular?
Well, all the information's online. I would encourage listeners to go to our website, portseattle.org, and you'll find commission appointment process there. But we will be having a public open forum, kind of a roundtable town hall meeting on January 22nd at the airport, immediately following our regular commission meeting, and inviting anybody who's considering this or knows anyone who should consider it or just wants to observe the process to join us. It'll start at 5 with a little pre-briefing on port orientation, and then from 5:30 until whenever everybody's tired of asking questions, we as port commissioners will be up on stage and we'll talk about being a commissioner. We'll talk about what the port's been up to and hopefully encourage people to submit themselves as a candidate. We'll then take whatever that list is and we'll select 20 semifinalists and have those people address us in public session. They'll do that on February 5th. And then by February 12th, the commission will take that list and identify six or fewer finalists and then essentially let the community vet that, and there's a political process.
Oh, so the community gets to do some.
Well, they'll know who we're considering.
Yeah.
I'm sure that they'll weigh in. We will be also having two community forums where we'll ask these people to be on stage and answer questions from a model moderator and the community, and one will be in Renton, and the other, I believe, will be in Seattle at the Public Library.
What do you think people... Oh, by the way, the Kings have denied that rumor.
Oh, have they?
So but as soon as the rumor flew, the Sacramento Kings said... It's false.
It's good I was kind of reserved in my
Yeah, it's very good. What do you think people should be asking of a Port Commission candidate? I mean, what are the important issues that you think people should be asking?
I so appreciate that question. I find that as a Port Commissioner, it really helps to be truly understand our community, and the community is King County and the state, and have a true commitment to the long-term economic well-being of those of us in Washington. I mean, what we have is a unique place in the world. We have a healthier middle class than most of the rest of America, and that's because we're a production economy. We export a lot. We need to preserve that, and a port commissioner is in a unique position to actually foster and grow that. So that's number one. Number two, I think you have to be somewhat independently minded. You have to be able to make your own decisions, work well with others, be willing to compromise, and not just with fellow commissioners, but, you know, we work with 39 other cities in King County. We work with the legislature. We have, there's 2 million, I represent 2 million people in King County. We're all elected countywide. Over 1 million voters. So it is a pretty tall task to do the representative duty of making sure that the constituents are being served and understand what you're trying to do.
You don't think somebody should ask whether they support basketball in this town or not?
Well, no, I think it's fair to ask, you know, any question that people want to ask. Are you asking?
No, but I will. But first, let me ask you this. All right, so this is the process. Then this person is put in place. But they still have to stand for re-election.
That's right. So actually, this fall, voters will get to choose 4 out of 5 port commissioners, because state law requires that whomever we appoint will stand for election at the next general election. There were going to be 3 seats on the ballot anyway, mine included. And so now we're going to have 1 more, Commissioner Tarleton's.
Do you like it, by the way? Are you going to run again? Have you decided?
Yeah, I'll run again. I believe in public service, and I think that our Century Agenda is a great roadmap for how we can create 100,000 more jobs in our economy. There's a lot of things we can do, and so we've done the strategic planning work, and, you know, I probably, like most of the people listening, get tired of strategic plans that get written and get put on a shelf, so I want to focus on getting that done.
Tom Halbro is the Seattle Port Commission president, elected Port Commissioner. All right, regional initiatives. Strengthen access to global markets and supply chains for Northwest businesses. Sounds good.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Well, we do that. It's a lot of things that everybody knows. We could kind of, you know, rattle on transportation infrastructure, freight mobility, and those kinds of things. So, yes, it's true. It's that. It's also fewer than 1 in 10 fewer than 4% of businesses in Washington State export. And we have tremendous access to the world. And so just creating a better understanding of Washington manufacturers and agricultural producers of how to access global markets will improve.
That's not happening now?
Well, it's happening, but we really are doing it in a very fragmented way. If you look at how not only governance, but just the way regional initiatives happen or have not happened, we need to have a coalition that focuses on the effort and sustains a few key things that will make a difference. One, that's one, a logistics hub, and making it so that we actually can spur growth of local manufacturers here, those kinds of things.
How do you feel about your relationship with the Port of Tacoma? And, let's stick with that for now.
Sure. Well, so the Port of Tacoma and the Port of Seattle, we are colleagues on a host of things. We both are critical with our facilities, our terminals particularly, critical to the state's economy. And with that and the local governance, what happens is we oftentimes do find ourselves competing for commercial business, which I think is, at the end of the day, undermines the ability for Washington State to most effectively leverage the assets that we all have, because we're citizens of our state as well. We have just as much invested, although maybe not as much as those in Pierce County, but we're all dependent on what happens at Port of Tacoma. So I think that there's a much better opportunity to be working together to further the state's economic interests.
Well, in your strategic plan, what is that? What is that new relationship, if that's what
Well, it is hard for our strategic plan to really touch on it because we don't have the wherewithal to affect policymaking in Pierce County. This has to happen from the state level. So we are reaching out to Tacoma directly. I've had many conversations with my colleagues there, one-on-one meetings and others, and talking about how we can be working together more on freight mobility, on cooperation in terms of environmental stewardship and other things. And my hope is that we will be able to move to clearer, rational thinking in terms of how we address the marketplace, the global marketplace. Because here's the thing. Everybody kind of gets this. You back up a little bit. You look at a map. Puget Sound is one destination on the globe.
When you look at Seattle's physical location, Port of Seattle and Tacoma's, is Seattle... Well, what do you think of the future of Seattle? Whether you build a stadium or whatever happens down where the port is located, aren't you just restricted by access compared to Tacoma, to rail, to freeway, to...
In some ways, yeah. I mean, there's no question that Tacoma has more land. I mean, they have less urban pressure. But in fact, we have tremendous connections in our industrial areas where our port facilities are located. 509 is going to be completed one day. That's only going to improve it. We have direct connection to I-90, I-5, both rail lines. We have tremendous terminal facilities. We have a very strong Ballard industrial community. That also serves the industrial base that's in the south part of Seattle. So it's tremendous natural benefit. The threat to all of that isn't the value of that land from an industrial sense. It isn't the ability to grow industrial businesses and those jobs here. I mean, Vigor Shipyard said that, you know, I think they're planning on doubling their workforce over the next 5 years. I mean, right now, there's just tremendous bullishness. The struggle is stewarding it. And that's something that really requires thoughtful policy work on the part of the city, the county, the port, the state.
Well, Tom Albert, do you think, then now I'll take you to the question of the arena, do you think that you all are working together to steward that land, given the port's opposition to the present configuration of an arena down there?
Yeah, well, I do think so. So first off, I'll be clear, and I've been on the record before. I think it's unfortunate that is going to be a location for an arena. We've had that political, you know, conversation and debate. And you know, the decision's been made, so that's what's happening now. My job and the job of my colleagues and other policymakers is okay. So where do we go from here? We just made the job harder in terms of stewarding the industrial capacity. So we have to work together. Yesterday, we had a roundtable discussion. And by the way, you can see this on our website, portseattle.org. You can watch a roundtable discussion that included Seattle City Council President Sally Clark, all the port commissioners, members of the industrial community, talking about what kinds of policies do we need to be looking at to promote industrial health. I'll say one thing. You know, we want to be an environmentally sensitive part of our world. I'll propose to your listeners that maintaining an urban industrial base is probably the single soundest environmental policy we can have.
But you guys talked about it as if that wasn't possible. Now the arena looks like it's going to be there. Is it possible? Can you do that?
Well, I said it was possible. It just is going to require a lot more investment and, frankly, a political will that has been tepid. And
are you getting that investment in some of the infrastructure, overpasses?
Yeah, all of,
or is it still
all,
talk?
It's still, well, there's work being done by all the parties to identify, you know, early scoping of the EIS. So now's a good time for everyone to weigh in on that. There's work being done on the broader policy questions. And then, of course, there'll be transportation studies done that now look at what was a difficult situation. We're going to add this to it. So how does that change the equation? And then where does that drive the priority for the investment?
Is the port going to be part of the investment package on the on some of those things?
Is the part? Well, we're certainly being asked to be. And, you know, history is that we've been willing to do our part. The commission hasn't made any commitment on that, but I would say that there is a recognition that this industrial base and freight mobility is critical to our mission as not only a port authority, but I'd say even more comprehensively an economic development authority.
I may be asking this out of turn because I don't remember. Did the port put up the money that it was originally talking about putting up for the Highway 99 infrastructure and tunnel? Wasn't the port asked to put some money up, and then that money's been sort of held back for some time? Has it been all put in?
No, it hasn't been held back. The details of timing of the contribution and the various mechanics of the agreement are still being worked out.
But the commitment remains.
The commitment remains. Yeah. We need the deep bore tunnel. It's a good solution to what was a very complicated problem.
Tom Albro is the Port of Seattle Commission President. We'll have to talk again about some of your issues. And Gail Tarleton's leaving the port, so you could be the next port commissioner. There's a link at our webpage. You can go to the Port of Seattle's page to find out more about the process and the public process. And in March, there'll be another port commissioner appointed who will have to run to do the public service. How's the monorail?
Oh, the monorail's doing great, by the way. We just 50 years old and never looked better.
That's your other job.
That's my other
running the monorail. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
Windy and rainy in Seattle, 41 degrees. Expected to be breezy with showers for the rest of the day and a high of 48.
Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney. On the next To The Point, since the Newtown Elementary School massacre, the President and members of Congress are pushing for gun control with support organized by Gabby Giffords and big money promised by Michael Bloomberg. Can they combine the clout and resources to take on the NRA? Next time on To The Point from Public Radio International.
That's this morning at 11 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
Support for KUOW comes from Every Block. All the news and talk from Seattle's neighborhoods all in one place. More information at everyblock.com.
It's 9:22. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Librarian and book guru Nancy Pearl will join us to talk about self-help books in just a little over 10 minutes from now.
Are you sure? Did you do the math?
That's what I've got. That's what we're planning on anyway.
That's what we're planning
on.
We'll see. But first, a little education funding issue following the port. On January 5th, 2012, in McCleary versus State of Washington, the state Supreme Court declared the state in violation of its constitutional duty to make ample provision for the education of Washington's children. In response to the McCleary ruling, the Joint Task Force on Education Funding, made up of legislators and stakeholders, put together a proposal to fund the state's school system in the coming years, but not everybody on that task force agreed with that proposal. State Senate Republican Steve Litzau did not vote on the final proposal or the House Republican counterproposal because he said they weren't detailed enough and didn't give enough actual funding mechanisms in place. Now, State Senator Litzau will be most likely chairing the Education Committee in the new legislative session in the state Senate. So what's his plan, and how does he hope to fund it?
Money's part of the issue, but it's never the only issue. There's no correlation between student performance, student success, and money. You have to, and don't get me wrong, you have to get, we've got to put some more money in the system, but we've got to be smarter about how we're spending this money. Right? We have continued to put money into the system, and we haven't seen the results. We've got to start holding ourselves accountable to making sure that everybody gets the education. And we can't keep pouring new money into an old system that we know isn't working for everybody. And expect something different to happen. That doesn't work.
Well, State Senator Steve Litzau, that sounds like you're talking another round of education reform. We've gone through almost 20 years of various proposals to education reform. We're still at the same place in terms of the state Supreme Court saying you're not putting enough money into the system.
Well, remember, what the Supreme Court actually said was, you guys define, your paramount responsibility is amply provide for education. You guys define the education the way you've defined it. Doesn't work, and you've got to make sure everybody has an opportunity I think they said to participate in the economy and a democracy. So their issue wasn't, you guys, you know, you're not funding the way you defined education. Our point is, by just putting more money into the current system and expecting a different result, that's the definition of insanity, right? We realize we got to put more money into the system, but we got to do it in a smarter way, that we start moving the numbers, that we start making sure that every child's successful.
Well,
so, of course, we're going to continue. We've got to continue to reform it. There is no unlimited funding here. It's not like you can keep pouring money into a system and expect the results.
What's your plan for changing education in the next 2 years while you're also looking for money?
Yes, and we're working on that right now. And it's going to, you know, how do we start bringing transparency, technology, work on teacher effectiveness in next years? And that goes around, you know, you'll see some legislation around in putting technology in the system. You'll see around grading the schools, A, B, C, D, and F. You'll see around how do you get into a blended learning system, right? How do we start moving to more mastery-based outcomes versus, well, they have to be in their seats 180 hours, right? I mean, we've been very input-focused, and we need to sit. And if you look around at places like New York and Colorado and some of these guys that, starting to see some improvements in student success, and it's around technology, it's transparency in data. How do we make sure we've got the great teachers in those rooms, and how do we make sure those kids are prepared to learn?
Well, all right. But are you sitting down with the teachers union and the OSPI head, or are you sitting across from them and fighting?
Hopefully we're sitting down with them.
But what do you think right now?
Right now, everybody's been very open, and everybody wants to sit down and figure it out. Mary Lindquist sat on the finance committee meeting. So, you know, it's going to take everybody to sit down and figure out how to make this work. But if we're going to hold the schools accountable, we've got to hold ourselves as legislators accountable. I mean, you know, to sit here and say, we're going to start making a bunch of changes, but you still are failing 24% of the kids, and we have for the last 6-7 years. You know, we need to make that increase at graduation rate 80% in 5 years, 85% in 10 years. And then let's have the conversation about how do we do that. Here's a whole bunch of ideas. Tell me how those are going to start moving the numbers, how we can make more kids successful.
All right, State Senator Steve Litzau represents the 41st Legislative District. He's in his second term. I want to take you back to the question of money again. So first, tell me again where money comes from to increase, I understand it's crazy to go too far, but to increase funding for education this biennium.
And this biennium, it comes from the $32 billion that we're going to be bringing in taxes. Right? We have $32 billion.
So no new revenues. It's going to be a switch in priorities. So what won't be funded?
That's what we're going to debate.
I know. Well, what do you want to see not funded?
Oh, there's, you know, that you've got way too many issues there. Right? I mean, what my priority right now is to make sure that early learning in K-12 and, quite frankly, higher ed, the entire education system, we start putting more money into that area. But what we're going to have to figure out, and your point is right, and I don't have the answer at the moment, and that's what everybody, you know, Andy Hill, who's the Senate Ways and Means Chair, and Ross Hunter, who's the House Ways and Means, I think they have a new name for it now, everyone's sitting down figuring out how to make this work. But I think what's become very clear is we can't make any more cuts, and we got to the education system.
Well, it sounds like you're going to make big cuts, and people have said you've already cut to the bone in the social services part of the state government.
Who said that?
Well, you've already made big cuts. People have said that, and I don't know where else you're. I don't know where you're.
We actually didn't make any cuts last year.
No, but you have over the last 4 or 5 years. Social services have seen some of their growth severely trimmed. Would you accept that?
Let's be clear about what you're talking. An Olympia cut. You're not actually talking a cut in actual dollars. You're talking about, well,
I'm talking about.
We forecasted $150, and we only spent, you know, we put in $125.
Yeah, but did you control the population growth and the demand on those services?
Pardon me?
You didn't. You still had increased demand on those services over those last few years.
And what we're saying is that those should grow at population growth and inflation. Right?
And they've grown faster.
And I know where your next question is going, because we've got the Affordable Health Care Act coming on board. And right now, nobody has a very clear understanding of how that's going to impact the cost.
Well, for a time, you're hoping for federal dollars, aren't you?
Yes, we are. So hopefully we can keep, you know, the issue there is, can you keep the cost down?
Yes. When you're looking for that money to fund pre-K through 12, state public universities are also asking for an additional $225 million in return for not raising tuition for the next 2 years. What do you think of their proposal?
I think it's something we've got to look at seriously. Right now, I know we're not interested in making any additional decreases to the higher ed system. I mean, we've got to make sure we were sitting down with Boeing and Microsoft, and they're saying you guys are not producing enough engineers and computer science degrees for us to fill our open headcount. We sat down with Michael Young. Michael Young, president of UW, is concerned because 50% of the kids graduating and going on to UW from our K-12 system have to have remedial work. All right, so my focus as an earlier in K-12 is make sure that President Young doesn't have to sit there and reteach these kids for 2 years and spend money doing that.
Steve, give me one example from what you've looked at where you think it's not about increased dollars, but it's about doing a better job. What's a better thing that this educational system could be doing that the state legislature can influence?
Be more transparent. I think we need to, one of the things is that we start admitting where we have success, showing where we have success in schools, and we've got a lot of schools that are doing really well, and where we're not doing well. And right now it's really hard for parents and the community to figure out what schools are doing well and what they aren't. And so I think one of the things you're going to see is a much more transparent system that says, this school is doing well, this school isn't. Let's go figure out why this school isn't working.
At the end of this legislative session, you have to go back to maybe not just your district, but some districts around you and say, these kids who weren't going to graduate, we've set up this system, now they'll graduate. We've made it better. Is that your goal?
That's my goal. I don't know if I hope we can do that. But yes, we have a moral imperative to make sure that we're not failing 15,000 kids every year, right? And you're basically then, you know, condemning them to a life of poverty and minimum wage job and prison. I mean, we know this.
Well, everybody agrees with that. It's the way to get there, right?
Right. And so we've got to sit down and make sure we can all get there. We have to, right? And we got to start holding ourselves accountable for it. And it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be pretty.
All right, how do I hold you accountable to that? At the end of this year, when we talk again, what's the question I ask you about accountability? What are you going to demonstrate?
You're going to say, Steve, what did you guys do that got us to an 85, you know, that increased the graduation rate in the next 5 years? Tell me what you've done to do that.
Well, we'll ask him that in 6 months. State Senator Steve Litsoe represents the 41st Legislative District. He was a Republican member of the Joint Task Force on Educational Funding. Monday, he tells me, or soon thereafter, he expects formally to be named as the chair of what the Senate has for Education Committee. We'll find out more about what their policies are in the weeks ahead. This is Weekday.
It's 41 degrees in Seattle with a predicted high today of 48. Forecast says it's going to be breezy with showers through the rest of the day. Overnight, clouds and showers,
maybe some flurries up above 300 feet with an overnight low of 34. And tomorrow, Thursday, cloudy. Chance of showers or flurries. Tomorrow's snow level 500 feet and tomorrow's high 41.
KUOW thanks the members of the Broadcasters Circle for their generosity and leadership support throughout the year. For more information on how you can become a Broadcasters Circle member, visit KUOW.org.
Hey, we're in Radioactive today. Down in the studio, we'll do it all day. We're voicing and recording and editing all. We still gotta go.
Feeling the beat? Apply to Radioactive, KUOW's free storytelling workshop. Youth ages 16 to 18 can apply at kuow.org/radioactive.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medical Center's robotic-assisted surgery team. Using advanced technology, UW Medicine surgeons provide robotic-assisted and minimally invasive surgeries designed to enhance patient outcomes and safety. More at uwmedicine.org/stories.
It's 9:35. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Starting today, Vice President Biden is holding a series of meetings at the White House with the goal of trying to figure out what to do about gun violence. More about that in our 10 o'clock newscast, which is 25 minutes away.
What makes a good self-help book? That's what Nancy Pearl is going to tell us and also get some thoughts from you. Nancy Pearl, I see here that your favorite self-help book is The Dance of Anger by Harriet Lerner.
It is, and it has been for years and years and years. It's one of those books that maybe... Harriet Lerner is a very down-to-earth psychologist. She worked at Menninger's Clinic in Kansas, in Topeka, and she is somebody who quite clearly understands how people interact and the kind of problems that can sometimes cause. All of her books are really good. I would recommend all of them. Really.
I see she has many dances.
She has many dances.
Fear, yes. Anger, connection.
Yes. Intimacy.
Intimacy, deception.
One.
Oh, yeah.
But for me, the first one, The Dance of Anger, has always been absolutely the best one. And I'm not a big one of the reasons I'm looking forward to this half hour is because I'm not a big self-help book reader, because really what I want are stories and good characters. And in Harriet Lerner, I get a little bit of that.
Oh. Anger is a signal and one worth listening to, writes Dr. Harriet Lerner in her renowned classic. Why? Why was that interesting to you? Was somebody angry in your life? Were you angry?
Oh, I think probably when I read it, I think I was angry.
You were angry?
Yeah.
Ah.
But I had a father who was very angry as well.
So you wanted to understand that anger?
I wanted to understand the phenomenon of feeling that way, that sort of... And how it could be helpful. I mean, how you could turn that strong emotion into something much more positive.
And did you? I mean, did it help?
I think I was somewhat successful.
I mean, so it was a self-help book that helped.
It was. And, you know, a question that I frequently get is people wanting books about how to deal with the death of somebody that they love. And the two books that I suggest are not self-help books. One is probably shelved in the picture books, and that's Leo Bascaglia's The Fall of Freddy the Leaf. And the other one is a novel by Kevin Brockmeyer called The Brief History of the Dead. And both of those books just give me enormous comfort. And so I think that's something... that we wouldn't classify as a self-help book, but that sense of giving you comfort, I think, is really important in some ways.
Nancy Pearl is an author and a one-time librarian and now librarian of the world with what'd you say, 7,000 Twitter followers. I am one of them.
7,000 plus.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Which just gives me the excuse to say we're trying to get up to 5,000 plus Facebook friends. So if you friend us weekday on KUOW, you will find ways to come to Nancy Pearl's book lists and her own pages and her own work.
Uh-huh.
So make it easy and help us get to our number. And our number is, by the way, otherwise, 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. self-help books that have helped you. Hi, Steve. I heard this morning on the way to work that Nancy Pro will be talking about self-help books. So I thought I would send you a shameless plug for my new book, Rise Above Your Divorce and Land on Your Feet. See, a lot of people, and this is Beth Rand. Oh, Betty Gordon, she wrote under. A lot of folks have turned to the self-help genre as a way to, well, get heard because they have good ideas. Right. Feet, by the way, financially secure, emotionally stable, efficiently operating, and tomorrow-focused. A lot of people offer that, you know, that they use that as a venue, and you find them helpful. I mean, and they find them helpful, and you want them to.
Definitely find that. I mean, it's a huge market, and I'm not saying. I guess what I would say is that for me, there are bits and pieces of different books that have really, I think, illuminated something for me. I don't know if they've changed my mood or whatever I was looking for, but that kind of illumination, I think, is really useful.
Well, how were you changed? What books helped you? What do you want to share with us? 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Or you can email us, weekday@kuow.org, or like us on Facebook, Weekday on KUOW, and post there. Do they have to be well-written?
Well, for me, they have to be well-written. That's the problem, because the quality of the writing is just something that I just am unwavering. I cannot read not good writing.
Nancy writes, yes.
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to say that I just finished a fabulous literary biography by D.T. Max called Every Love Story is a Ghost Story, a biography of David Foster Wallace, who suffered all his life from depression and anxiety. And very little could help him. I mean, pharmacologically, he was on an antidepressant for much of his life. But I know from reading that book, there is no way he would have ever picked up a self-help book. And I think I was thinking when I was reading that book, how sad it was that he didn't find, you know, this brilliant mind. How sad it was that he couldn't find what he was looking for, what he needed to live a happy life. And Virginia Woolf, the same way. You know, I often think if Prozac had been invented back, you know, in the 1930s, I think that's when she walked into the water and killed herself. Or Sylvia Plath, I mean, or just the ordinary person.
Well, I mean, those books... Do we think books can help even those that are chemically, clinically?
I think chemically, probably not. I mean, maybe they can offer something, a glimmer of something, but I think chemically, probably not. But I think that, right, they can't, I don't think.
Well, we'll see what I mean. I don't mean to put you on the spot. Let's see what other people say. It's an interesting question. I looked at that David Foster Wallace book. I thought about him.
Yes.
In that. So Nancy Matthew writes, Passage Meditation, Bringing the Deep Wisdom of the Heart into Daily Life by Eknath Iswaran. I guess we'll make a list of these as well. At some point, I determined I wanted to try meditation as a form of self-help. First read this book in search of method of meditation. If you're hoping to read a self-help book that you can put into practical use, you'll soon find what seems basic on the surface leads to an amazingly effective method of meditation and a very rich set of spiritual tools.
And there are a lot of really interesting and good books about incorporating meditation. Jon Kabat-Zinn, for example, is a really a prolific writer and the people who have worked with him. And I'm blanking on the woman who I would recommend.
And I don't know what your first name is. Nessner is your email. I'm a 65-year-old woman. These two books helped me when I was around 25, 30 years old. Winning Through Enlightenment, Ron Smotherman. Psycho-Cybernetics, Maxwell Maltz. But we don't know why. I want to know why they help. But here's another one. Hands down, this is Ed and Jonelle. Hands down, Winning Through Enlightenment. Ron Smotherman. Found it in 1994. I've been reading it continuously ever since. An excellent guide to growing into a responsible person or into responsible personhood.
Hmm.
Winning Through Enlightenment. Well, John and Queen Anne, what's yours?
Hi, I've benefited over the years from reading the Dalai Lama's book, The Art of Happiness.
And so you read it more than once?
I read it again and again with Howard Cutler. It was written with this doctor, Dr. Howard Cutler. And also I benefit from having a copy of Miracle of Mindfulness by Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. And what, give me an example.
Yeah, I was going to say, talk more.
It makes me, my life have meaning because I know that there's meaning in the world. And I think a lot of people are out there looking around for meaning and they can't find it. And they're young and they're angry. And they I see them and I try to have compassionate thoughts for them. And I think that one person in the group being mindful helps the entire group. And whether it's a class, people on a bus, whatever, because that's the original form of being prepared is to be mindful and not to have the American way might be to have a gun and rather than saying I have a gun and I not need it is worse than having a gun and not having a gun.
I get you, but mindfulness, being mindful, I get you. All right, John, thanks. I appreciate that. Wendy writes, for marital difficulties, I think the best book by far is Susan Johnson's Hold Me Tight. A wonderful writer on topics such as dealing with shame and the value of vulnerability is Brené Brown, also a different book. And any of her books are worth reading. They're research-based, heartwarming at the same time, and you can see her TED Talk. So Brené Brown about vulnerability and Susan Johnson's Hold Me Tight. That's all I got. I can't give you more. But perhaps Maureen can give us more. Maureen's in Union. Is that a street or a town? Union, Maureen.
Down on the elbow of the Hood Canal.
Yeah, that's right. You have a lot of big oyster shells on the beaches down there.
We have the biggest in the world, I swear. Yes, they even made a commercial about it one time.
Is that right?
A beer commercial. We were daring enough to swallow a whole raw giant oyster, got a free beer, I think was the way it went.
Oh, man. That's a big oyster. All right, what's your book?
It would be When Bad Things Happen to Good People by Harold Kushner.
Huh.
That's an old chestnut of a book, yes.
Right, exactly. And it was, basically, it was written by a rabbi, but it was particularly helpful for me because I had a daughter that had an undiagnosed problem, and then the University of Washington, everybody tracked it down. It was called Rett syndrome. But then, lo and behold, it's very devastating, very devastating, like, Harold Kushner's son. But I just threw myself into the science, so people began to wonder about why I wasn't taking it as personally. Well, of course I was taking it personally on a spiritual level, but Harold Kushner really just was beautiful about why we incorporate all facets of life, why we incorporate science and enlightenment and serenity. Because what happened for me is I ended up having more kids and grandkids, and it's only supposed to happen to girls, only happens once in a lifetime, never happens more than that, and lo and behold, if I don't have five and a boy, a grandson who died after a year of terrific struggle. But we found the gene with it through Stanford and Baylor, and I worked with all those guys. And I think that having that base for me from Kushner was, it ain't personal, people. If you can sometimes move out of a big tragedy sometimes and make it, you can really accomplish a lot. You can actually change the world. And I felt like I had changed the world because he taught me how not to take it so personally.
Well, a great testimonial.
Yeah.
Thank you for that, Maureen. I appreciate that. When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Harold Kushner. Tell us more about some of the books that you've been using to help you make it in the world. How to Talk So Your Children Will Listen and Listen So Your Children Will Talk. Scott thinks the title is. The book is also the best book about communicating with adults. I use the tips all the time.
Yeah.
Because we are all children.
Right, right.
So that should
be. We all have the emotional age of a child.
My favorite self-help book is The Anatomy of Hope by Jerome Groopman, Amanda writes, which describes how hope can affect the way people deal with illness. I think it's sort of the paralleling to what we just heard Maureen
say.
Yeah,
and Jerome Groopman is a wonderful writer, regularly writes for The New York Times. His books are just for the New Yorker, sorry, maybe the New York Times too. But I always look forward to his books.
That's great. When my mom was dealing with a diagnosis of cancer, this book helped her face the uncertainty of cancer with strength and positivity. She now gives this book to anyone she knows dealing with the illness. That's good. The Anatomy of Hope, Jerome Groopman. The Mindful Way Through Depression, Mark Williams, John Teasdale, Zindel Siegel, John Kabat-Zinn, Using Mindful Meditation to Overcome Depression. That's from Chica Rosa. And Mindset by Carol Dweck. Hmm. But I don't know that book. And Sadarsky, I need more. The Power of Habit by Charles Duhigg is a great book in the sense it opens your eyes on how our habits shape our lives and how some people succeed in changing their daily routines and why other people don't succeed. That's from Mike.
Well, years ago, there was a book, a self-help book out called Your Egregious Zones. And it was given, people bought it. I mean, it sold, in my memory, at least at the bookstore where I was working, many, many, many copies because people either didn't understand what egregious was or they thought that it was erogenous. They misread the word. And so they bought it, which I always think is very funny.
That is funny. Well, Erogenous Zones would be a good book. Yeah. And it could be a good self-help book. Nathan's in Ballard. Hi, Nathan.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. What's Insurrection?
It's not so much a self-help book. It was more of like a layman philosophical book, but it's called Insurrection by Peter Rowland. And in it, he sort of challenges the Western addiction to being contented and happy and sort of, it's sort of an anti-self-help book in that he sort of challenges the idea that anything is necessarily wrong with you if you're unhappy. So I don't know about for other people, but at least for me, that was eye-opening in that I felt called into a deeper and richer existence and that, you know, I could embrace all the moods and emotions of life rather than feeling the need to live up to this ridiculous Western notion of being happy all the time.
Great.
That's interesting.
Thanks for that.
And something on that same line is Susan Cain's book, C-A-I-N, her book Quiet, How to Be Introverted in a Noisy World, or something like that is the subtitle. And I know my older daughter read it and said that it really helped her understand and feel more comfortable with herself because she's very quiet and very introverted. So I think that that's the kind of book that does that what the caller was talking about. It just helps you feel a sense of self-acceptance.
Gloria in Bainbridge. Gloria, that sort of follows up on what Nancy's saying, your book, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that there are two books that I was going to mention, but I have to actually second or third or fourth on Jerome Groopman's book on hope. I used to work as an oncology social worker and really found that book was incredibly helpful and realistic in a way that I think a lot of books just aren't. They are sort of championing you into that, you should be happy or you should find why something's wrong with you and that's why you have cancer. And I just found Jerome Groopman's book incredibly helpful. But the two books I would recommend are, one is Happiness is an Inside Job, and that's by Sylvia Boorstein, who is a therapist down in California, and I just saw her at a conference about a year ago and was really struck. She's like a Buddhist Jewish grandmother, and her book is so personal and nicely written. She talks about her own difficulty in meditation, even though she has been doing it for like 40 years and just is very kind to herself, which I find a lot of my clients are always just, why can't I do this better? What's wrong with me? And her book just keeps sort of cutting through that and giving examples about how we're all just human and we need to be kinder to ourselves. And the other one that I recommend to, again, adults and parents is Laura Kastner, who's a local author and psychologist, called Getting to Calm. And Laura's amazing to see in person, but it also comes through in a book she's writing about what's been discovered in terms of adolescent brain science and then how to help parents work with that rather than just, you know, giving consequences or punishing or, you know, just reacting to their kids. And it's very humorous but very practical, and I've given it to parents of all ages, parents of adult children, and they just, they're like, wow, this is so helpful. And it's really about calming yourself at those moments of, you know, when you're reacting. So.
Great. All right. Good. I appreciate those suggestions. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have to read all those.
I know. Well, Sylvia Boorstin is somebody who's, I have not read, but I've heard just wonderful things about.
The Boy That Was Raised as a Dog, a great inspiring read on how children can overcome trauma through solid relationships, Michael says, gives me hope to have a happy childhood even 30 years later. Mm-hmm. And by the way, Jessica writes, as someone who's been clinically depressed and suffers from social anxiety, I would agree with Ms. Pearl that a book cannot take the place of pharmaceuticals. However, contradictory to that, the book Alcoholics Anonymous has served to change me without the use of medications. I was a low-bottom drug addict living on the street and in and out of jail and institutions. My AA sponsor read me the book because I could not comprehend because of the damages I had done to my brain. I will say that as a result of the book speaking directly to my heart, encouraging me to do 12 steps, I've recovered from my addictions. I don't know if this book or the Bible would be considered self-help, though. I think it would, don't you think?
Well, and David Foster Wallace actually was the biographer talks in the book about how the many years he spent with Alcoholics Anonymous and how rigorously he tried to follow those 12 steps.
Hmm. And Heidi writes, when my friend died suddenly at the age of 19, I felt overwhelmed with grief, didn't know how to cope. Her mother lent me one of the many books she was reading. I wasn't ready to say goodbye, Surviving, Coping, and Healing After the Sudden Death of a Loved One by Brooke Noel, Pamela D. Blair. As the authors describe in the beginning of their book, there are many books on grief for long illness, however, not many on sudden death. Mm. I felt great comfort from this book, as if these women knew exactly how I was feeling and gave great tools to move through and get back to living. Highly recommend it. That's from Heidi.
Don't you hope, Steve, that all those parents in Newtown have people like these people who can share some of their own story and suggest books that help them?
Yes.
Because that's just what that book, it seems to me, what the caller just, the book she talked about, that sudden death. Yeah.
Ugh. All right. Teresa, I'm going to let you weigh in at the end here with a question or a comment, yes?
Great.
Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. Both a comment and a question, actually. I enjoy the books by P. Melody. She's a senior clinical advisor for the Meadows down in Wickenburg, Arizona. It's a recovery center from emotional trauma. They treat sexual addictions, alcohol addictions, drug addictions, and codependency. Anyway, I like Pia Melody's series of books called Facing Codependence, Facing Love Addiction, Facing Alcohol Addiction, and so on. I really like the books. I think they're where the rubber hits the road. She actually takes the 12 steps.
Spell her last name.
Melody, spelled E-L-L-O-D-Y. Her first name is Pia, P-I-A. Again, she's the senior clinical advisor for the Meadows.
I see.
In Wickenburg, Arizona.
What was your comment or question about why a stigma on self-help books?
Yeah, that's my question. When I bring up these books or any of the self-help books, any of them, and I'm a great reader of them, they say, "Oh, I don't read those books. They're so silly. They're nonsense." Why is there such a stigma, a discrimination against these books? And it seems to me that people have kind of an avoidance behavior. I'll take my question.
All right. Well, you know what? That is a fine question to end this on, mm-hmm. and let's figure out a way to address that question in days ahead, because that's a really
that's a very good question.
We have a lot of suggestions from email and on our Facebook page. We'll put together a list, share it with you on Facebook. And Nancy Pearl, you're off to Bosnia?
I am, on Saturday.
And you're going to do a little talking and teaching? Oh, you're flying?
Yeah, flying on my birthday.
You're going to do some talking and teaching?
I am talking and teaching, helping people learn how to lead book discussions that deal with difficult topics for the American Embassy, the State Department.
Great. You'll tell us what it's like.
I will.
All right. We'll see you again.
Thank you, Steve.
This is Weekday.
And now, the sound of the day.
Well, speaking of travel, Willie Weir and Cat Mariner bicycling around Southeast Asia in Cambodia, they came upon a large carved wooden bell around the neck of a water buffalo. The bell clanks as the buffalo grazes. They said they saw several water buffalo wearing these wooden bells in all their travels. They were unique to them, quite unlike the clank of metal bells on sheep, goats, and cows. Water buffalo in Cambodia. What are you hearing? Send us a sound of your day. Weekday at KUOW.org.
Wooden bells. I like that.
Yeah, I am transported. Aren't you? I'm in the field in Cambodia with them right now.
Yep, I'm there. It's all happening.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.